Welcome to Thinking Aloud, a podcast about the nexus of politics and all those things that make us human. From the Lindenwood University College of Arts and Humanities, I'm your host, Don Heidenreich. With the final withdrawal of U.S. troops from Afghanistan, it seems now like a good time to look at how we got here and why we got here, the implications of our actions, and where we might be going. To consider these questions, I have as my guest today, from Lindenwood University, Dr. Dale Walton, Professor of International Relations, Dr. Brian Arndt, Assistant Professor of International Relations, and Dr. Marcus Smith, Assistant Professor of History. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's go ahead and just start with the big question. Was what happened in Afghanistan inevitable?
I'd take that one. I think that the U.S. not succeeding in building a healthy Afghan democracy was inevitable. The way that the U.S. lost with this incredible humiliation, that was not inevitable.
Dr. Smith?
Oh, what a great question. I would start by affirming comment that the dramatic and sudden reconquest of Afghanistan by the Taliban was certainly not inevitable. It was very avoidable. The larger question of whether the failure of democracy in Afghanistan was inevitable, I think, depends quite a bit on what you consider democracy and what you think that looks like. I think democracy in terms of a democracy that would look like ours, let's say, would probably not work in Afghanistan in our lifetimes. A representative government of some sort, whether we call it democracy or not, I think absolutely has a place in Afghanistan. I think the questions that remain then are, what is the relationship of the national government to the hinterlands, to Afghanistan's tribes and other forms of leadership? And how is that representation going to function exactly as the real operative?
So ultimately, then, why was it a failure?
Well, to begin with, the American government lied to itself constantly for 20 years, as well as lying to its own people. Everything was an illusion. It was all a self-perpetuating, hollow effort. They managed to spend roughly $2 trillion, according to many estimates, although you can get wildly different figures depending on how you do the accounting. And it was all a Potemkin village. It all collapsed immediately. And that really shows a deep problem within the U.S. government. And that problem, the U.S. hasn't even begun to address.
What would that problem be?
That essentially careerism and various kinds of metrics and artificial goals have replaced any organic sense of how you do statecraft.
Were there signs that we should have seen from the beginning that this was going to, even if it didn't have to end this badly, that this was still going to end badly?
Well, the fundamental question was the initial intervention. The intention might simply have been to catch a terrorist in this case, but the Bush administration began to see this as a case of a failed state, and that was a rising theory in the 1990s, in a sense that if you don't do something about such failed states, then their problems will spread regionally, in the case of haven for terrorists, even internationally, and that saving a country from itself, if you want to call it that, and rebuilding it so that it will never fail again was one of the arguments for the intervention. That then brings into question whether this is really the responsibility of either one country, the United States, or the international community.
Was the United States attempting to live off of previous experiences that they thought might have been successes in an attempt to recreate that in Afghanistan?
In a lot of ways, although I think that Brian's comment really gets to the heart of it, that there was this although it's largely collapsed now, failed state paradigm that most definitely the Bush administration was working under, but it wasn't unique or new to them. You really saw that take hold in the post-Cold War period. And this idea that the Bush people were saying from the very beginning that Afghanistan couldn't be allowed to be a place that sheltered terrorists. But many of us who were in the field of strategic studies and similar areas never really bought that argument, in that, to me, it was always ludicrous, because if there's not Afghanistan, there's Sudan. If there's not Sudan, there's Eritrea. That you could keep going down the line to places that are troubled and where terrorists might be able to shelter. And so I think that the whole thing was always built on an illusion of absolute power, that you could eliminate terrorism if you just drained all the swamps, and that's not possible.
Was it possible the United States, though, looking at some place like Bosnia and saying, well, while state building is one thing, nation building is another, that we did have at least a modicum degree of success in nation building in Bosnia, and thus maybe we could use that as an example of a way to make that happen in Afghanistan?
I would think that did serve as an influence, although to my mind it should have served as a warning, because the Americans and the European allies were extremely lucky in former Yugoslavia. Looking back, if the Serb population in Bosnia had wanted to do a long-term guerrilla war and had fought the way that the Taliban fights, it would have been an absolute fiasco. And they didn't do that, and the Americans and other observers thought, oh, well, that means that that won't happen in the future. They were wrong.
I think it's important to note that the United States didn't face the kind of broad-based insurgency in Afghanistan that we did in Iraq initially. We actually took Afghanistan militarily much quicker and easier, frankly, than we had anticipated. The return of the Taliban came later after the failure of the state-building effort that was underway. And if I were asked to point to one major mistake that was made in that state-building or nation-building effort, it was the kind of state that we encouraged the Afghan leadership to set up under Hamid Karzai, which was incredibly centralized, where the office of Hamid Karzai oversees everything down to the appointment of teachers in local villages. So that this is an example of where we talk about setting up a democracy, but there are a million questions about exactly what kind of democracy are we talking about, not only in terms of theoretically how does power function, but also how does the bureaucracy function? Do people in villages get to select or vote for or appoint their own teachers and administrators, or is all of that done directly from the top down? And I think this is a case where our Orientalist tendencies got in the way, and we said that for a country like Afghanistan, you're going to need some direct top-down power. And I think that actually had the opposite effect that we expected. I think that's what generated a lot of the resistance that ended up bringing the Taliban back.
Well, I think we also have to look at, and Marcus, you can comment on this one too, is the fact that if we were trying to compare, say, Bosnia, Yugoslavia, Croatia to Afghanistan, we would find there's no real comparison between the conditions, especially the history, the culture, the traditions. Even though a lot of Southeastern Europe, maybe at least parts of it, are Muslim, it's a very different kind of Islam. And a lot of Southeastern Europe was under the Turkish yoke, I'm going to call it that, for centuries. Their sense of nationhood, I guess you could almost say, is more well-developed. Afghanistan, as from my, this is a little bit out of my area, is a tribal nation, if I'm not mistaken. Conquests were relatively uncommon, whereas the Yugoslavia began its independence after World War I. It was a fully functioning nation state. So whatever the intervention in Bosnia was like, you're dealing with apples and oranges.
And I'll have to confess a lack of expertise getting into the more particulars of tribes in Afghanistan, the more kind of anthropological questions. But what little I've read, I think there are a limited number of useful parallels there in that it is a very multi-ethnic country. Part of that actually goes back to a shared experience of Turco-Persian rule. You mentioned the Turkish empires. They did have a past experience of multi-ethnic empires. This points to the fallacy of the statement that I often hear that it's the graveyard of empires. No empire has ever managed to conquer Afghanistan, which I actually don't think is very true. I think the historical record actually doesn't bear that out at all. No empire ever established a fully centralized state or induced Afghans to develop nationalism in the way we think of it. But Afghans, as I understand it, have quite a bit of experience in their history of acquiescing to all different types of imperial rule and to recognizing when it's practical, when they have interests in acquiescing to a sense of a common, I wouldn't say identity, but a shared fate as Afghans, when that's practical to do so. I think that's the distinction I would make between Afghan society, so far as I understand it, and let's say the way that we tend to think about nationalism. Nationalism as a almost mythical kind of ideal, a deep part of our psyche. For Afghanistan, I wouldn't say that they're unified by a nationalism in that sense, but they can develop a sense that they have a shared fate. And that is something that the historical record does show has at many times united the tribes behind a common Afghanistan to a certain extent.
So are there lessons from history that might have warned the United States as to what we were getting into?
Well, the Soviets. The Soviets were actually the last and greatest before the U.S. in a long line of experiments to impose a more absolutist system on Afghanistan, starting with the first couple of British wars in Afghanistan. And what happened with those was that Afghans mobilized popular resistance against outside conquerors. But part of the effect that had was that it built a new expectations among Afghans who had many of them in the hinterlands, especially before then, actually not carried an expectation of participation in government. They found it normal to expect conquest and normal to expect changeover from one empire to the next. They just didn't necessarily expect it to impinge that much on their daily lives. So the experience that you see with the British during their two wars in Afghanistan and with the Soviets, and actually, I think you could argue also with the Taliban, is that all of these efforts failed because they were efforts to remake Afghan society in a relatively uniform sort of way.
You listed the Taliban's first effort at governing as a failure. Is it possible that if they don't change their policies, they'll fail in this new effort?
I think it's absolutely possible. And I'm thinking of some recent work that I read by Thomas Barfield, who makes this argument that something that sets the Afghan people apart from, let's say, how we in America are used to thinking of politically is when it comes to politics, Afghans, especially in tribal settings, just tend to be much more pragmatic. So even the adoption of ideology is often done for much more pragmatic reasons than we tend to think of it here. This is why part of the reason the defeat of the Taliban came so easily for the United States was because once superior U.S. air power made the defeat of the Taliban look imminent, which didn't take long, most rank and file members of the Taliban simply left the Taliban and joined the winning side. They had a long experience of doing this. So could that happen again? Quite easily, I think, under the right circumstances. Hard to say what those circumstances would be exactly.
Have we seen anything different this time around in the Taliban, or should we expect them to possibly govern pretty much as they had in the past?
Based on everything we've seen so far, I expect them to put the boot down.
Well, this is a little bit out of my space. My only sense of it is that perhaps the conditions are the same. I mean, we have an ongoing, there have been predictions of a mammoth humanitarian crisis in Afghanistan. It's questionable what the United States will do in those circumstances, but I will say this, that if we're going to talk about this later, the Afghanistan is reaching out to the Chinese. China has hesitant to intervene in the situation for a variety of reasons. First of all, it does share a border with Afghanistan. It's very small. The biggest problem for China is the fact that it's afraid of its terrorist movement that developed in the northwestern province of Xinjiang. The Chinese have more or less defeated it, but it remains in parts of Pakistan, I believe, Kazakhstan. And the fear is that at least one terrorist group, the one that carried out the recent bombing as the airport was evacuated, has threatened and perhaps will carry out terrorist activities in China, which then makes the Chinese hesitant to support, either humanitarian or otherwise. And it, so far, it has hesitated to recognize the Taliban as the government of Afghanistan.
Dr. Smith, what do you think about it?
You know, I'm the historian of the group, and as you know, historians always reticent to make predictions about the future. We like to stick with the past. But having said that, what can we expect from the Taliban? I'm sure just because so much has changed in 20 years, we can expect it to be different. I'm not sure exactly how. Probably not necessarily different in the ways we would like it to be different. I don't put much stock in their promises of protecting human rights and giving women more voice and things like that. I expect them to try to put on somewhat of a show of doing that, at least as long as it serves their interests. And I think the only thing that could possibly help is that the Taliban finds it in their interest to be less isolated than they were the last time they ruled Afghanistan. So for those reasons, they may try to give the appearance of being a little bit less objectionable to the international community. How far that will actually go in terms of protecting the rights of women, protecting human rights, and things like that, I'm not optimistic.
Marcus's point, I think, is worth talking about because, yes, this problem of legitimacy that the Taliban had in its earlier incarnation, the Americans largely solved it. You took a government that, as of September 11th, 2001, was recognized by almost nobody, faced a very serious resistance movement, and all of these factors, and now you have a Taliban that is, by the United States itself, has effectively been treated as the legitimate government of Afghanistan. And there's a larger background there, which is circa 2001, people still took the end of history or whatever you want to call it seriously. No one now believes that human rights are on the march, or no one who's realistic. You look at China, you look at the general world situation, you look at the COVID crisis. This is a very different world and one that's more amenable if you're the Taliban in a lot of ways.
So in the long run, how does this play out? What can we expect to possibly see in Afghanistan and with U.S. policy in the region?
Well, there's a strong suspicion, although I'm not sure it's well-grounded, that the Chinese and perhaps also the Russians will replace the United States. China has a fairly strong relationship with Pakistan, as it has through past decades. It also seems to be furthering its connections to Iran, although that's kind of hard to say. It continues to assist nations such as Saudi Arabia with economic development to a degree. And China imports a considerable amount of oil from the Middle East, too. So it's uncertain that way. One of the things that is definitely unlikely is for China to ever replace the United States in terms of guaranteeing the security of any state in the Middle East, because China's ability to project power and put troops in the Middle East is extremely limited, and China's interests in military activity lie farther away. So that's highly unlikely. Whether the what so-called Belt and Road Initiative will lead the Chinese to acquire some sort of base or some area of operations in Afghanistan, I don't know. That seems to be questionable.
Yeah, it may not be anything where the Chinese feel that they need a formal permanent base or anything like that, although I would not be at all surprised to see Chinese firms coming in, signing mining contracts. You'll probably very likely see security personnel who are former military and think like U.S. contractors in Afghanistan. So that wouldn't surprise me. But I would be very surprised by any kind of formal alliance or anything like that.
Well, also any type of deal of that nature, especially when you're dealing with the Saudis and the Iranians, could be very problematic, to say the least, for their relations with either side. So the moment they start making a deal with one, they're going to be off-putting the other. So how are our allies in the region viewing this? How might they view this? And how might that affect our relations?
Honestly, I think the U.S. has left the board of the great game. And I hope it has. I think that it was hubris for the Americans to get so deeply involved in Central Asia, that it was inherently imprudent. I think Marcus's earlier point about how the war changed. Yeah, the U.S. won the war in 2002, and then it proceeded to lose it because it refused to leave the field. And now Afghanistan's fate, I think, is largely going to be determined by Pakistan and China and Russia and India. And I think that the Americans are, or should be, if they're prudent, side players.
I would go off of what you're saying and add that I think it's not just about America reassessing the size of our role in the world, but also what kind of role that is. I think for too long, we have thought of our role in the world primarily as military. And as someone who pays attention to these things now and someone who spent some time in the military myself, I've just come to feel that the military is extremely important. It's needed for some things, but there are a lot of things the military is not necessarily good for, and we shouldn't be asking the military to do. I think we should think about our role in the world in a more holistic sense. I think we should invest more in diplomacy. I think we should reevaluate and be more thoughtful about a lot of our economic investment in the world as well, some of the aid we give and things like that. But I think we should be asking ourselves not just where should we and shouldn't we be at war. First of all, military presence doesn't always mean war. And there's a difference between having 100,000 troops in a country and 8,000 troops in a country. All of that to say, I think it would benefit America, I think it would benefit the world, and I think it would benefit our military to be a lot more thoughtful about what role we really ask our military to play in the world.
Plenty of places where we have small military force that we have it there by treaty, that it's been there so long, we've forgotten that they exist. They're there, like in some cases, a security force that stopped being a security force, and now they're kind of more as a diplomatic shake hands, how is everyone doing type of force. So it's kind of an interesting aspect of the U.S. military.
Right.
But you're right, there's this bigger question about where we put the big forces.
Well, and it's interesting to think about on that point, who you have playing that role. I'm not saying we shouldn't have the kind of missions you're talking about, but I'm saying that's interesting to think about. We basically have military personnel in a diplomatic role. Am I understanding you right?
Yeah, actually.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, so, it fell into that.
And I'm not saying I'm answering this question. I'm saying that's a really interesting question. What effect does that have, that we have the military playing a diplomatic role? On the one hand, with how much we defund the State Department, I guess someone has to do the job. But on the other hand, what does it mean for countries and foreign people in general to interact with U.S. soldiers in a diplomatic role as opposed to diplomats in a diplomatic role?
Are there other countries in the region, though, that because of the way we handled Afghanistan might have had a shift in their views about us?
Yeah, that definitely seems to be the case. Can't speak entirely about Russia, but China definitely has seen the United States go more or less go down to defeat. And will it actually step in? One of the things, like I mentioned, is that the Chinese don't see their role as sending 100,000 troops to the Middle East and overthrowing a government. Chinese method of foreign relations is largely with economic and what we call soft power diplomacy, eschewing the use of military force unless it's unbelievably necessary, usually to protect Chinese nationals, maybe. But even then, it's rarely used and unlikely that it would be used. So China may be plotting the U.S. defeat, at least in the sense that it's the U.S. reputation has gone down a few notches, but actually stepping in and taking over its role seems to be kind of unlikely.
I think that there is a wider question that, to my mind, the U.S. has reached a stage in its imperial life cycle where there is a form of imperial collapse happening. And I think that the longer the Americans try to refuse to confront that reality that they have an unsustainable vision of their role in the world, that the worse it will be and the harder the fall. These are conversations that should have happened 30 years ago. And instead, the U.S. essentially took its Cold War strategy and squared it. Then instead of protecting the free world from the Soviets and everything else, that now there was a mission to make a liberal democratic world. And that vision has collapsed utterly. And at this point, I think the United States would be wise to consider how it can begin to trim imperial commitments, where it needs to be, where it doesn't need to be, and to really have that conversation seriously. In the case of Central Asia, my own personal attitude is the U.S. should be marginal. In the case of much of the Middle East, I think there's a case to be made for should the U.S. be in the Persian Gulf. I'm not sure.
I don't think there was anything about this U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan that surprised anyone in the Middle East. So I don't think the reactions that I've seen so far have been terribly drastic, and I don't expect any policy reversals towards the U.S. from the region that I follow. As I said, because I don't think this came as a surprise to anyone, the United States' attitude towards the places that were militarily engaged in the world, it can be kind of funky, let's say. We also pulled out of Iraq rather abruptly, and pulled out not only militarily, but also to a large extent diplomatically. We pulled out our involvement altogether. We had these two different cases in both Iraq and Afghanistan, and they're very different countries in and of themselves. But in terms of U.S. foreign policy, we committed to a boots-on-the-ground sort of military presence, large-scale, taking casualties, the kind of thing that gets domestic American attention, as it should, becomes very unpopular. And then we, just like we fixated on invading that country, we fixate on getting all the boots out, rather than doing a sort of rational cost-benefit analysis. How small could we have gotten the force in Afghanistan down to and prevented collapse? What kind of reforms could we have tried to incentivize in the Afghan political system to try to prevent this collapse? So in both cases, we sort of reached this point where I think in both President Obama's case in Iraq and in President Biden's case in Afghanistan, I'm sure out of their own personal convictions about what the right thing to do was, but also out of a response to domestic opinion in America, they just said, we're out, 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 and consequences be damned to a certain extent. That is part of what precipitated the rise of ISIS in Iraq, and it precipitated the quick return of the Taliban in Afghanistan almost overnight. I am a person who is relatively critical of American empire, as Dale was terming it. I think, as I said before, we need to be a lot more thoughtful about exactly what kind of missions we ask our military to engage in and what we expect them to try to do. But I'm also very critical of quick, hasty withdrawals that cause a lot of damage and tragic consequences.
And you're absolutely right about that. And I think that's actually one of the problems that you get with this kind of imperial collapse is everyone lies to themselves, to the public, mm-hmm. until finally it gets to a point where the levee breaks and everything mm-hmm. collapses.
And I think it's really important to add, when President Biden announced his plans for withdrawal from Afghanistan, if you listen to the whole speech, he announced an unconditional plan to withdraw from Afghanistan very soon, very quickly. And in the same speech, also doubled down on the war on terror, essentially.
Yes.
So to your point, Dale, his withdrawal from Afghanistan was not part of what I'm suggesting we should do, which is a sort of broader kind of reassessment of U.S. defense policy, foreign policy around the world. Not in any way. He's doubling down on that. Basically, the same kind of activity we've been doing. We're just not going to do it in Afghanistan anymore.
Exactly. The foreign policy Washington blob is amazingly immune to evidence and wants to go back to doing what it does. Mm-hmm. And yeah, there is this deep systemic tendency that I think is one of the problems of the fact that American foreign policy has not had a really serious rethink about what the U.S. is trying to do in the world in a very long time.
Mm-hmm. And we need it
dearly.
And we as American citizens should be demanding it.
Absolutely.
On that note, gentlemen, thank you for your time. We'll have you back to continue this discussion on Afghanistan, its consequences and impacts. Thank you for listening. We'll be back soon.